We're going back 850 years before Christ to the beginning of the book of 2 Kings. Keith just read from there. That's our text this morning. King Ahab had just been killed, and his son Ahaziah had taken the throne, but he soon died from an accidental injury in the first chapter of 2 Kings. Since he had no son to ascend the throne, another one of King Ahab's sons, Jehoram, Ahaziah's brother, took the throne. Chapter 2, 2 Kings chapter 2, Elijah just had left this world in a remarkable way, and Elisha took his place. In the third chapter, we see an international conflict taking place involving the kingdoms of Israel and Judah and the ungodly paganistic nation of Moab. In chapter 4, our attention is brought back to the care and concern of individuals. When Elijah was alive, he administered to families. Elijah ministered to individuals. And we begin to see Elisha following in his mentor's footsteps. 2 Kings chapter 4, verse 1 tells us that one day the widow of a member of the group of prophets came to Elisha and cried out, "My husband who served you is dead, and you know how he feared the Lord. But now a creditor has come threatening to take my two sons as slaves." The fact that this woman was a widow of one of the prophets, and the mother of two sons, shows that the prophets were not a celibate monastic group. Jewish tradition says that this widow's deceased husband was the prophet Obadiah. In 1 Kings 18, verses 3 and 4, we're told that Obadiah was the prophet who hid and fed 100 of the Lord's prophets from the murderous wrath of Jezebel. Josephus accepted that tradition, that her deceased husband was Obadiah. And he even stated that the debt which the woman's husband had acquired was contracted for the purpose of feeding those 100 faithful prophets of Jehovah whom he had hidden in the caves. In our text, the widow mentioned that a creditor had come and was threatening to take her sons as slaves in order to repay the debt. The legal system in Israel would not allow her to declare bankruptcy. According to Hebrew law, a creditor could take the debtor and his children as servants as payment for the debts, though he was not allowed to treat them like slaves. For example, Leviticus chapter 25 is one passage that mentions this, verses 39 through 41. "If one of your fellow Israelites falls into poverty and is forced to sell himself to you, do not treat him as a slave. Treat him instead as a hired worker or as a temporary resident who lives with you, and he will serve you only until the year of Jubilee. At that time, he and his children will no longer be obligated to you, and they will return to their clans and go back to the land originally allotted to their ancestors." Some think this practice disappeared after the exile, but in Matthew chapter 18, where Jesus tells the parable of the unforgiving servant, we learn that the practice was apparently still in use in some form during Jesus' day. Matthew 18, beginning in verse 23, Jesus said, "Therefore, the kingdom of heaven can be compared to a king who decided to bring his accounts up to date with servants who had borrowed money from him. In the process, one of his debtors was brought in who owed him $1 million, or millions of dollars," this translation says. "He couldn't pay, so his master ordered that he be sold, along with his wife, his children, and everything he owned, to pay the debt." Now, this might seem inhumane to us, but the creditor, the one that we're talking about in 2 Kings 4, was within his rights to take these children. It would have been heartbreaking for this woman to lose her husband to death and then lose her two sons to servitude. Our text is 2 Kings 4, verses 1 through 7, which was read a few minutes ago. We'll reread the text as it goes with our points this morning. Reading verse 1 again. We've noted that this verse introduces us to the woman in need. It reveals the problem she faces, and it sets a good example for us to follow. I'll read the verse again. One day, the widow of a member of the group of prophets came to Elisha and cried out, "My husband who served you is dead, and you know how he feared the Lord, but now a creditor has come, threatening to take my two sons as slaves." This verse makes it clear that this widow knew where to go in time of need. And that's an important thing. The widow went immediately to seek the wisdom and help of God. Lots of storylines in books and movies have been developed based on someone going to the wrong source for help, or taking the wrong advice, or becoming indebted to the wrong person. Often when we're faced with adversity, we don't want to admit that we need help. But when seeking help, some people go to those who tell them what they want to hear. That's the only people they will consult. They seek counsel from those whom they know will agree with them or that will give them information and advice that they want to hear that's pleasing to their ears. If you give them advice they don't want to hear, they simply will not consult you anymore. Hagar the Horrible is the title of a main character of an American comic strip which comments on modern-day life in the United States through a loose interpretation of Viking-age Scandinavian life. In one comic strip, Hagar the Horrible climbed a mountain to ask a guru, a sage, a wise man, about the meaning of life. The guru said the meaning of life is found in self-denial, eating in moderation, celibacy, abstaining from alcohol. Well, if you know anything about Hagar the Horrible, he was the opposite of all those. There was silence for a moment. Then Hagar said, "Is there somebody else up there I can talk to?" We're told that the truth will set you free, but that's true only if you love the truth. Truth will not set you free if you reject it. Who we go to for help reveals a lot about us. It reveals our priorities. It reveals something about our motives. It reveals our character. Old Testament prophets ridiculed God's people for turning to other nations or other gods for help instead of turning to Jehovah. For example, in Isaiah 31, verse 1, "What sorrow awaits those who look to Egypt for help, trusting their horses, chariots, and charioteers, and depending on the strength of human armies instead of looking to the Lord, the Holy One of Israel." In the introduction, I referenced Ahab's son Ahaziah, who died due to an accidental injury. The account begins in chapter 1, verses 1 through 4. After King Ahab's death, the land of Moab rebelled against Israel. One day, Israel's new king, Ahaziah, fell through the lattice work of an upper room at his palace in Samaria and was seriously injured. So he sent messengers to the temple of Baalzebub, the god of Ekron, to ask whether he would recover. But the angel of the Lord told Elijah, who was from Tishbe, "Go and confront the messengers of the king of Samaria and ask them, 'Is there no God in Israel? Why are you going to Baalzebub, the god of Ekron, to ask whether the king will recover?' Now, therefore, this is what the Lord says: You will never leave the bed you are lying on. You will surely die." So Elijah went to deliver the message. Blessed are those who know where to go when they are in need. After the widow explained her dilemma, continuing with the text in 2 Kings 4, verses 2 through 4, we're told Elisha asked, "What can I do to help you? Tell me, what do you have in the house?" The widow said, "Nothing at all, except a jar of oil." And Elisha said, "Borrow as many empty jars as you can from your friends and neighbors. Then go into your house with your sons and shut the door behind you. Pour oil from your jar into the other jars, setting each one aside when it is filled." These verses tell us that the answer to her need was right at home. She told Elisha her problem, and his response was, "Tell me, what do you have in your house?" That's a good question. Some people think that good answers, right answers, have to come from somewhere else. They have to come from somebody else, from some source other than what we've known. And sometimes that's true. But it's often nothing more than what we call prodigal son, or what we could call, I don't know that I've ever heard it called this, but prodigal son syndrome. Got to look somewhere else. It's got to be better somewhere else. Often it's nothing more than a lack of contentment, a desire for something new and different. Often we undervalue the things we already possess, whether it's people or opportunities or things. But the instrument of this widow's blessing was something she already had. Notice her answer. She said, "I have nothing at all except a jar of oil." The Hebrew text here rendered a jar, a flask, or a pot, depending on your translation, is found only in this passage in the Bible. It perhaps refers to a very small jar normally used for ointments, for anointing the body, for after bathing, and to anoint the dead. The New International Version, the New Living Translations, translates this as a jar of olive oil. The word olive is not in the text. The more literal translations, such as the English Standard Version, New American Standard, New King James, say only a jar of oil. I understand that this jar was a jar of ointment or perfume, if you will, similar to what Mary used when she anointed Christ for his burial in Matthew chapter 26 and John chapter 12. This type of product was very expensive. In fact, Judas informed us of this in John 12 verse 5 when he said, "That perfume was worth a year's wages." This would make it easy to understand how the widow in 2 Kings chapter 4 was not only able to pay her debt, but was also able to provide a means of livelihood for a long time afterward. I'm inclined to think that would have taken truckloads of olive oil to have accomplished that. We often tend to overvalue things because they already belong to us. We can undervalue people, we can undervalue opportunities, and we sometimes undervalue things. When we are in need, we should first consider what is already available to us before we begin looking elsewhere. Now, beginning in verse 3 again, the text says, "Elisha said, 'Borrow as many empty jars as you can from your friends and neighbors. Then go into your house with your sons and shut the door behind you. Pour oil from your flask into the jars, setting each one aside when it is filled.' So she did as she was told. Her sons kept bringing jars to her, and she filled one after another. Soon every container was full to the brim. 'Bring me another jar,' she said to one of her sons. 'There are not any more,' he told her. And then the oil stopped flowing. When she told the man of God what had happened, he said to her, 'Now sell the oil and pay your debts, and you and your sons can live on what is left over.'" We see here that God blesses in proportion to our faith. This reminds me of Gideon. Gideon was not a remarkable man. He was not a leader. He was not a courageous man. But the Lord used him to lead 300 untrained and unarmed men to go into battle against a formidable army. And they were victorious. The army was described this way in Judges 7, verse 12. "The armies of Midian, Amalek, and the people of the east had settled in the valley like a swarm of locusts. Their camels were like grains of sand on the seashore, too many to be counted." The possibilities are unlimited when you allow God to use what you have. Elisha told her, "Borrow as many empty jars as you can." The borrowing of empty jars from others was an exercise of faith. Elisha made this woman commit herself in faith to God's provision. To borrow jars in this manner would invite awkward questions. The neighbors would get curious. And of course, the woman would be aware of this. What if nothing happened? What if the oil did not multiply? She'd have to bring the empty jars back and admit that she never used them. How much oil she gained was dependent upon how many jars she borrowed. And how many jars she borrowed was dependent upon how much faith she had, to a certain degree. For example, she would have been tempted to avoid going to a neighbor who was too nosy, perhaps. Or maybe she had a fallout with some neighbor. She might be inclined to avoid going to that neighbor. When we read this account, we don't think about the questions and the pressure this would create. Yes, I have three empty jars. What are you going to use them for? In fact, Becky just came over before you got here and said you borrowed four from her. And notice that Elisha made her do this. He instructed her to borrow the jars. He instructed her to close the door. He instructed her to begin pouring the oil into the jars. This was a test of her faith. God blesses in proportion to our faith. This is not some made-up principle. James chapter 1, verses 5 through 7, James says, "If any of you lacks wisdom, you should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to you. But when you ask, you must believe and not doubt, because the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea blown and tossed by the wind. That person should not expect to receive anything from the Lord." Too often we're satisfied with a teacup of God's blessings when we could have barrels and barrels, perhaps. James 4, verse 2 says, "You don't have because you don't ask." The text informs us that the oil began to multiply at some point. And so we ask, at what point did the oil begin to multiply? Well, it did not begin to multiply when Elisha told her what to do. It did not begin to multiply once she'd gathered all the jars and put them in their house. It did not begin to multiply when she closed the door. The oil multiplied when she began to pour it into empty jars. It was only when she acted on her faith that she began to see the blessings of God. Spurgeon commented on this passage, saying, "If she borrowed few vessels, she would have but little oil. If she borrowed many vessels, she would have much oil." She was herself to measure out what she would have. And I believe that you and I, in the matter of spiritual blessings from God, have more to do with the measurement of our mercies and blessings than we think. We make our blessings little because our faith is little. We make our blessings little because our prayers are little. So we need to seek help from the right source. And instead of looking for new things, sometimes we need to understand that God often begins with what we already have, and that He can take what we have and use it for great blessings. Moses had only a rod, a stick, if you will, in his hand, and God used that to accomplish great things. David had five smooth stones and a sling. And with God's help, David used only one of those stones to bring down the giant who was threatening the whole nation of Israel. The young boy had only a few loaves and fishes, and Jesus used that to feed thousands. What do you have in your house? What blessings do you have already? What opportunities are available to you right now that you are not taking advantage of? Someone has said, "Our God has boundless resources. The only limit is in us. Our asking, our thinking, our praying is often too small. Our expectations are too limited." We have God in the measure in which we desire Him.